Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Well, today we're talking with three amazing women. Each of them has created their own unique career by following their bliss, literally. As well as being passionate about their work, they're each making a difference in other people's lives. We're trying to get hold of my first guest right now, and I'll tell you about her in a little while. But my second guest is Seattle-based filmmaker, author, playwright, and human rights advocate, Jen Marlowe. And Jen's joined us a couple of times before, that she does amazing work. This time she's joining us to talk about a very specific message that she wants to get out along with Amnesty International. She's working with them on a case right now. And they're reaching desperation point. And so she's going to join us for a few minutes to talk about that. And then we're going to switch things up with my third guest. Her name is Grace Bonney. She literally blogged during her lunch hour. It became an obsession with her. That obsession led to a job offer from House and Garden. She then became contributing editor to House and Garden magazine and several other magazines. It led to a whole industry career for her. She now has a team of 20 writers working on the blog. And so I'm looking forward to talking with her about her journey and also some of the tips that she has for home design that are really cheap and quick. And I looked through her book and there's some great ideas in there, including how to create little gardens for yourself, sustainable home gardens. So we're going to talk with her toward the end of the show. First of all, I'm going to be talking, if we can get hold of her, Laura Caldwell. Her new thriller is called Claim of Innocence. And Laura was a partner in a Chicago law firm. She specialized in medical malpractice defense and entertainment law. And she created a program for people who were found innocent after they'd been convicted. She realized that it's a very tough road for people to do that. But she's also a thriller writer. So we're going to be talking about that and the life after her book and the Life After Innocence program, if we can get hold of her. She's supposed to be with us right now. She's MIA, but we're doing our best to find her. So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be joined hopefully by one of our guests today. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Please do stay tuned.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
Hi, I'm Vicki St. Clair. I want to invite you to join me every Monday at noon for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. We'll talk with innovative business leaders, medical and health professionals, authors, filmmakers, adventurers, and ordinary people leading extraordinary lives. Join me Mondays at noon for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, we all know the world can be a frightening place, and letting go of your kids is one of the hardest jobs you'll face as a parent. That's why Dr. Kenneth Ginsberg says building resilience in children is one of the best gifts you can give them. Please join Vicki next Monday at noon Pacific and follow on Twitter at hashtag Vicki St. Clair.
Don't touch that dial. You might miss something life-changing. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. Good news, we found Laura. It's Monday. It's a live show. You know, we're doing the best we can here. Laura Caldwell is my guest. And as I said at the beginning, I'm talking with three amazing women today, and Laura is no exception. She's the former civil trial attorney, now distinguished scholar in residence at Loyola University Chicago School of Law. And as I said, the director of the Life After Innocence program. And she's also an acclaimed novelist and has been published in Chicago Magazine, Woman's Own, The Young Lawyer, and many other books. Laura's new thriller is Claim of Innocence. Laura Caldwell, welcome.
Thank you. This sounds like an interesting day of interviews you're having.
It certainly is. It's going to be interesting. We're switching gears in the last half of the show, but the first half we're going to be talking about your book and your Life After Innocence program, and then we'll be talking with Seattle-based filmmaker. But so let's just jump straight into your book, because this is your seventh book?
I can't even believe this, but it's my 12th book.
Okay, because so. I couldn't count. There were like different numbers all over the place.
I started, you know, writing late in life. I was a lawyer and a partner at a law firm before I ever picked up the craft of writing, even a little bit. So I always said, and it took a while, though, once I started writing to get published, and I always said, if I get my foot in the publishing door, I will kick it open.
So what made you want to write? Is that something you'd always wanted to do?
No, and I think it's important for everybody to remember this, too, that, like, you know, people, I'm interested sometimes when people say, you know, I'd love to paint, but I'm just not very artistic, or I'd love to do this, but I'm not really, I don't have that in me. I went to University of Iowa, which is one of the best writing schools in the nation, and did not take advantage of it, didn't have any interest in writing, and never had been a writer my whole life. But after practicing law, I was a partner at a law firm. We did medical malpractice defense, and I just felt like I needed something creative that didn't have to do with my family life or my work life. And I've always been an avid reader, not a writer, but just thought, I wonder if I could ever write a book. And I just started taking a class, and literally because of finding time to do this new craft that I was learning, which I was not particularly, you know, I wasn't like a diamond in the rough or anything. It definitely took a while, but I found that I was a better lawyer and a better wife ultimately because I was making time for this hobby that once I started it, it just thrilled me.
Yeah, I can relate to that because I think if you engage in a creative hobby or pastime, whatever you want to call it, it opens up all other aspects. It inspires you in other aspects of your work. But I know your work has also inspired your creative work.
This time in particular, as I said, I used to just be a civil litigator. Now I run a program at Loyola Law School in Chicago called Life After Innocence. And what we basically do is work with people who were innocent but wrongfully convicted. So you hear about DNA evidence, getting people off who never convicted, you know, who never did the crime. If that happens in Illinois, and unfortunately we in Illinois have a rather high number of wrongful convictions, wow, then my law students work with them to basically just start their lives over because there is so much to handle. I mean, you and I are both doing the, you know, should we be on Twitter? Should we do this? And imagine if you didn't, most of them don't know how to use the internet at all.
Right. You said Illinois has an unusually high ratio of convicted innocent people, mm-hmm, who are convicted. Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, Texas is always sort of known as the big offender, but in actuality, it's Illinois. Now, I have always wondered the same thing, and since I don't actually get people out of jail who are innocent, I just work with them after, I have asked this question, and I've been told in large part it might just be because we do have quite a few organizations in Illinois that are devoted to making sure there are not innocent people in our prison. So it may just be simply because we're putting more resources toward the cause, so to speak.
Right, so you're actually finding more. Interesting.
It might be, right. Yeah, but it's interesting because there are now, when we say an innocence project, that's loosely, we call, use that term to talk about projects around the nation and who are basically looking for letters from prisoners who say, this is not me. I did not do this thing. And if they think there's enough evidence to look into, they will look in to see whether this person is innocent. So about 10 years ago, there were 9 innocence projects in the country. Today, there are 70.
Wow.
So it's quite a, we're finding it's quite an issue in our country, and therefore more and more projects are springing up to try to address it. And then what we particularly found at Loyola Law School was that there just weren't a lot of services or resources for people who did get out. If you're fortunate enough to be, you know, everyone agree, hey, geez, sorry about that, you were innocent of this crime, it's massively difficult to start over, and there were a minimal amount of resources. So we're actually, we are now a member of this Innocence Network, one of the first to do this post-innocence work.
And you may have said this, but this all began because when you were researching your sixth novel, you came across a case where somebody had sat in a holding cell for, 6 years without... without a trial date set?
It's crazy. You wouldn't think this would happen in the U.S., and particularly
no.
I didn't believe it would have happened in Chicago, which I see. Chicago has its issues, and everybody knows that, but I see it as a particularly, you know, a well-oiled machine in many ways for all its failings. I wrote a book called The Rome Affair, and it's about a girlfriend's trip to Italy that leads to blackmail and murder. And at some point, I had these police officers in Chicago trying to force this married couple, who they have in different interrogation rooms, to say that they committed murder. And you don't know in the book if they did or not.
Mm-hmm.
But I really didn't know if this forced confession thing ever truly happened. That seems strange to me that, you know, you hear about people, they confess to something they didn't do. That always sort of troubled me. I ended up calling a lawyer I knew just to do some research, and she told me about a young man who had been in Cook County, that's Chicago, holding cell. So we're talking a holding cell, not, you know, a place you go, a prison is you've been convicted and now you're
right.
off to prison.
Right.
This is a holding cell where you wait for trial if you cannot post bail or bond.
For
6 years, a 19-year-old kid who'd never had any trouble with the law, and he'd seen a fight but not been in a fight, but because he was there and you know the people who got in the fight and someone died, everyone was arrested. And 6 years later, he was charged with death penalty murder, and he was still in this holding cell.
Wow.
So, yeah, this you would love this attorney, Kathy O'Daniel. She is a dynamo, and she took his case on and said, this is insane. And eventually I would work with her, and in particular it was seeing how hard it was for him to get out when he did. He did get a not guilty. He was innocent of this crime. And when he got out, though, boy, trying to start over when you've been in a vacuum, particularly in today's day and age with technology and everything, it's like you're walking back into a new country. It's like someone dropped you in Bangkok and without any money and just said, hey, good luck to you.
Mm, shocking. Really shocking. Well, it sounds like you're doing great work, and unfortunately, it's needed. I mean, it would
right.
have been nice
I know.
If it wasn't
or
needed.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about Claim of Innocence,
your new
book.
I'm really, really proud of it, and it's for the first time I've sort of marrying my fiction with the work I do in my day-to-day life. So Claim of Innocence is the force in the Izzy McNeil mysteries. Izzy McNeil is this sassy, redheaded lawyer from Chicago who moonlights as a private detective. So in the first three books, Red Hot Lies and Red Blooded Murder, there was this sort of crazy, nutty redhead on the loose in Chicago who's getting herself into all sorts of trouble. We wrote these books as a trilogy, never intended to sort of come back to the character. And I went on to write a book about that gentleman I told you, my client, who had been in a holding cell for 6 years. I wrote a book called Long Way Home, my first and only nonfiction book. But what was happening was on the back end is that Izzy was getting a lot of readers who wanted her to come back. So Claim of Innocence is this forced Izzy McNeil mystery. And she and her best friend are defending someone who is accused of poisoning her own best friend to death. And this whole innocence subplot that runs through it, and I won't ruin it, but I really got to learn from the exonerees I represent and learn from the people who are doing all this work to get innocent people out of jail. And I really got to use it in this fiction novel, Claim of Innocence. So it's still a fun, fast thriller. Izzy Susie remains sassy and irreverent, and they're very fond. But it really was interesting to get to use this innocence work that I've been so deeply involved in on my day-to-day level in my fiction, you know?
Yeah, and you can definitely see that threaded through there. One of the statements that a character made in the beginning of the book was that we don't ask if the client is guilty or not. Is that something that really happens with defense lawyers?
Yeah, I mean, and if you think about it, you know, this attorney that I mentioned, who I wrote about in the book Long Way Home, who is the main lawyer for this guy who was in that holding cell, she sometimes does not ask if the person who she's been hired to represent is guilty or innocent, because that is not her job. Her job as a criminal defense lawyer is not to determine their innocence. That's the job of the jury or the judge. Her job is to make sure that this person, if you are a citizen of the U.S., she believes that you deserve to be arrested fairly, interrogated fairly, and have a fair trial. And so she sees herself as, I'm the gateway to fairness and justice in this system. I'm not here to determine guilt or innocence. So in some cases, yes, that's definitely, you know, whether someone is guilty is definitely not a question that always has to come through in a case when you take a case on. I thought that was really interesting, too. It's fun that you raise that.
Yeah, I've seen, like in films, them say things like that, but you don't know how much is, you know, fiction Hollywood versus reality. But it makes sense, I guess, what you're saying there. You know, my next guest, as I said, is filmmaker and activist Jen Marlowe, and she's going to be talking about a clemency hearing coming up. As an attorney yourself, what do you have to share with us about eyewitness accounts? Because, you know, the studies that I've done have said how unreliable eyewitness accounts can be.
Yes. I mean, really quite unreliable sometimes. And there's no, you know, we're going to have to do things to make that better somehow, but we can't really get rid of it. I mean, you know, if someone stole your purse, you're in Seattle, you go to your cops, you say, someone just stole my purse. You're the only person who was around. We need to rely on you. And the fact that you're saying it was a young blonde woman. She ran up to me and she stole my purse. So we need eyewitness accounts. But one of the best books I've ever read that shows the particular dangers of eyewitness accounts is a book called Picking Cotton. And it's by a woman named Jennifer, I'm blanking on her last name, but she wrongfully picked out of a lineup a man named Ronald Cotton. She had been raped as a college sophomore. She was sober. She was paying attention. She wrongfully picked this person out of a lineup. And what happens with memory is that once you've put this new person or their image into your head, that is, in fact, who you recall doing the crime. So to her, years later, when he was exonerated by DNA evidence, she couldn't get over it because that's the person she always saw in her head as assaulting her that one day.
Wow.
And so they have finally now, they have become best of friends. She asked him for forgiveness. He said, of course, he knew it wasn't her fault. But it really is a tricky situation, the unreliability of eyewitness testimony. There are a lot of interesting things going on in the legal world, and that is one of them. We're really trying to figure out how can we address it? How can we make it better? And I don't think anyone has the perfect answer to that.
I don't think so when we're dealing with humans, too, on that level.
That's right. But that's also why, thank you for saying that, Vicki, because that's also why when people say, you know, our criminal justice system is broken, I don't really agree, to be honest. It is a human system, as you point out. So we are not machines, and therefore this justice system is not going to operate in a machine-like fashion.
Mm-hmm.
So we all have to be aware that mistakes can be made. I think the fact that you're talking about this and to people like myself and your next guest is really important. Just so we're not saying that everybody's innocent who's in jail or everybody who picks someone out of a lineup is wrong, but it would really be helpful if we were all aware that those things do happen, just so that we don't put up such a big wall when someone makes that accusation. You know what I mean?
Yeah, perfect. I totally agree. We are right at the end of our segment, Laura. I could talk to you for many more minutes. But it's gone quickly. What would you like to leave our listeners with today?
Oh, thanks. You know, I've thrown so much information at you, but lauracaldwell.com is my website. You can get the new book, Claim of Innocence, there. You can also read the first chapter of all the books, including that nonfiction book I told you about, Long Way Home, which, when I first wrote it, I really wrote it because I was this man's lawyer and friend, and I was all about him and his story. But it ended up, I talked to so many detectives and lawyers and saw how hard the system is. So it's really a look, at least at the Chicago criminal justice system. So, but go to the website, and I thank you so much for having me on. This is the delight of my day. Thank you.
Well, good. And you can find out more about Laura Caldwell, as she said, at lauracaldwell.com. And book list called Laura's new book, one of the most talented... We got kids there.
Yep,
one of the most talented and inventive writers around, to which many of her readers would agree. So thanks for being with us, Laura Caldwell. And please do stay tuned. When we come back, we'll be joined by Seattle filmmaker and activist Jen Marlowe. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
Manson Mitchell, Mastery and Mystery, on Alternative Talk 1150 KKNW.
50 years ago this month, Betty and Barney Hill took a weekend trip to Canada.
By the time they returned home to New Hampshire, they had experienced something that would change the way millions look at the universe.
Kathleen Martin, Betty's niece, joins Manson Mitchell on Saturday to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Betty and Barney Hill UFO abduction case.
That's Manson Mitchell, Saturday at 10 a.m. Pacific.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicki St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicki asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
1150kknw.com. It's why they invented the internet. We think. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Well, I told you we were talking with three amazing women today, and Jen Marlowe is no exception. She is an amazing filmmaker. I'm not going to waste time sharing all the many wonderful and important projects that Jen has worked on. She's joined us twice before on the show. But because Jen is here today to share a very specific message with us, and we don't have a great deal of time, I'm going to bring her on. Jen Marlowe, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks, Vicki. It's great to be back on your show.
Well, you sent me this story through, and I looked at it, Jen, and I was like, you know, is that something I really want to cover on the show? And then I looked at it a little bit more, and I thought, how could I not? So I'm glad you're here to talk to us today on this subject. We're going to talk about a case of Troy Davis, and he does have an execution date set for this month, and you're trying to get a clemency hearing, as I understand it. But I'm going to just throw this over to you, first of all, because Amnesty International got involved in this story with Troy Davis. So tell us why they got involved.
Well, Amnesty International got involved with Troy Davis's story once it became clear that there were such egregious problems with Troy's case, and when it became clear that Troy really had a strong innocence claim. Troy was convicted in 1991. He was convicted for the 1989 murder of a Savannah, Georgia, off-duty police officer named Mark McPhail, and the conviction was procured primarily on eyewitness testimony. And I know I heard your last guest talking about the notorious unreliability of eyewitness testimony. In Troy's case, there's an additional factor that 7 out of the 9 eyewitnesses later recanted, saying that they gave that testimony implicating Troy under duress, under conditions of police coercion and intimidation. And yet Troy has not been able to find relief in the legal system, which leads us up to his execution date, which is scheduled for Wednesday, September 21st. Amnesty got involved both because of the very compelling questions of innocence in Troy's case, but also because of their belief that Troy's case is one of the cases that really highlights and underscores all that is problematic with the U.S. death penalty system. It's not, Troy is certainly not the only innocent person who has been on death row. There have actually been 138 people exonerated from death row since 1973. So people are convicted and sentenced to death. Some have come within hours of their execution or have had their execution dates already established before they were exonerated. And so in many ways, Troy's case is emblematic of the larger problems facing a capital punishment system.
Mm-hmm. Now, why did you get involved with Amnesty International? They came to you, I understand. How did this work?
Well, I got involved in Troy's case, first and foremost, and I got involved because I heard Troy's sister, Martina, speak on Democracy Now! This was in 2007, and it was right after Troy had survived his first execution date. He came within 23 hours of execution in 2007, and then he came within an hour and a half, 90 minutes, in 2008. And I heard Martina speak about his case, and I began to look up information after hearing her talk about it, and Amnesty had just done their first report on Troy. So I found that quickly as soon as I started researching, and then wrote to Troy in prison, found a website with an address, and started corresponding with him, and then have since met his family and gotten to know them and have been working with them and working on his case. And Amnesty has been working in such close partnership, also, you know, working on Troy's case and working on calling for preventing his execution based on the fact that there's so much doubt in this case. And so it was natural that I would then get in touch with Amnesty and work in alliance with them.
Mm-hmm. Now, as I understand it, just to give full disclosure here, Amnesty International, on the clip that I saw, said they're not making a stance on whether he's innocent or whether he's guilty, but they are making a very strong stance on the fact that there is too much doubt, correct?
Absolutely true. Amnesty is not taking a position on Troy's innocence or guilt, but what Amnesty is saying is that there are so many doubts, so many lingering questions, so many problems with the conviction, and therefore it would be absolutely unconscionable to proceed with an execution when there is a strong innocence claim.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that 7 out of 9 eyewitnesses have now recanted their original statements?
Either directly recanted or seriously contradicted. And out of the two who did not recant, one is someone who other witnesses have come forward and implicated this man as the shooter. So there's actually a strong evidence of an alternative suspect.
Right, right. And almost all star witnesses, we've talked about the star witnesses, but I also saw a juror who said that if she knew now or then what she knows now, he definitely would have been found innocent in her eyes. Is that true of other jurors?
I don't know about other jurors, but I do know that this one particular juror, and her name is Brenda Forrest, that's exactly what she said on an interview to CNN in 2009. Her direct quote was, "If I knew then what I know now, Troy Davis would not be on death row. The verdict would be not guilty."
Mm-hmm. So what is it you hope talking with us today will accomplish, Jen?
Well, I want folks to know about this case, and I want folks to know that there are still advocacy efforts that are being made on Troy's behalf. He does have a clemency hearing scheduled before the Georgia Board of Pardons and Parole. That hearing is on Monday, September 19th, 2 days ahead of his scheduled execution. leading up to that hearing, there are still actions to be taken, but they must be taken now because it's all coming to a head. For folks who go to justicefortroy.org, there are petitions that can still be signed. There are specific sign-on letters for members of the clergy to sign, for lawyers and legal professionals to sign, that all go to the Board of Pardons and Parole with the basic message, there's too much doubt to execute. On Friday, September 16th, is a day of global solidarity for Troy, and there actually will be an event happening in Seattle, most likely at Westlake Center. Some of those details are still being announced, but if folks want to know more about that, they can email me at troyanthonydavis@yahoo.com, and I can let folks in Seattle know the details of the Seattle solidarity event as they emerge. And it will most likely be on Friday, September 16th, which is the day of global solidarity for Troy.
Okay, and that email again was troyanthonydavis.com.
TroyAnthonyDavis@yahoo.com would be the email address for more information.
Okay. And so your call for action then is, you know, get in touch with you if people want to learn more about this and the Seattle event that's happening up here. What else would you like to leave us with today?
Well, for the Seattle event, and then, of course, the website justicefortroy.org has all the links to petitions and other actions that folks can take. It also has links to a video series that I made with Amnesty International that really illustrates exactly what we mean when we say there's too much doubt. It really unpacks his case thoroughly. And I think those are the actions that I would love people to take, but I think some of the thoughts I'd love people to leave thinking about is are questions about the U.S. death penalty system in general. The system is riddled with error. It's riddled with bias. It's riddled with inaccuracies. Troy's case is emblematic of that, but it's not an isolated instance. And there is still the death penalty in Washington state. There's only 16 states in the U.S. who have abolished the death penalty. Washington state's not one of them. I would love folks to think about what we can do locally here in Washington state to make sure that we are never going to execute a possibly innocent person. And the only way to make sure of that is by abolishing the death penalty.
Yeah, and there certainly seems to be enough doubt there that this definitely should be looked at. And I, you know, a lot of people have differing opinions on the death penalty. And, you know, they might say, well, a jury has, you know, ruled on this. But I always question, you know, how would I feel if this were one of my loved ones in this situation? You'd want them to have the benefit of that doubt. So I thank you for being with us today, Jen.
Thanks so much for making the time, Vicki. Appreciate it.
Sure. And you can find out more about Jen Marlowe and her work at DonkeySaddleProjects.com. She's an amazing filmmaker, playwright, author, and activist. And we'll be right back. Please do stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967, because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
Listen to the Marie Manucherry Show, where energy and medicine meet, every Tuesday and Thursday at noon. It's intelligent and provocative radio. Tuesdays is boot camp for the soul to help you soar. Thursdays, Marie interviews guests from an incredibly talented lineup. To learn more about Marie and her radio show, visit energyintuitive.com or connect with her on Facebook and Twitter. That's the Marie Manucherry Show, every Tuesday and Thursday at noon here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicki St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicki asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life, so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice, tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
No shirt, no shoes, no problem. Come as you are. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. Well, we've been talking about a heavy subject there right before the break, an important subject, but it was kind of heavy. We're going to end today's show on a lighter note, again, with another amazing woman who's crafted her own unique career path. After a short career in music, Grace Bonney took her love of art and design and began writing a blog during her lunch break. That led to a job at House & Garden. She then became a contributing editor for House & Garden magazine, Domino and Craft. And she grew her lunchtime hobby to a team of more than 20 writers covering everything from home design and do-it-yourself to projects to floral and design recipes. She's been featured on Good Morning America, The Nate Berkus Show, The Martha Stewart Show, and has been called the Martha Stewart for the millennials, Generation Y. Grace Bonney, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I should say, your new book is called Design Sponge at Home, which I believe is based around your blog.
It is. It's sort of the blog come to life in big, pretty book form.
Well, I think this is something a lot of people dream about. I certainly know a lot of people are hoping a publisher's going to find their blog and get them published. And this, when this happens, it's fantastic. It doesn't happen very often, but when it does happen, I think it's really great. It's kind of like the girl who wrote the Julia Child's blog. And all kinds of things sprung from that. But I want to go back and just talk a little bit about your career. You went to New York, as I understand it. You had a degree in art, fine art. You were born and raised in Virginia. You went off to New York to follow your love of music. Tell us about that phase.
Absolutely. I think that, like everyone who's fresh out of college and doesn't know exactly what they want to do, you sort of throw a lot of things against the wall and see what sticks. And I have always had these dual loves of music and design. I wasn't sure quite which one to pursue. So I started with music because it seemed sort of the easiest to get into at the time, actually. And it ended up just not being the place for me, and I didn't feel at home and didn't really feel like it was the community that was going to challenge me the way I needed to be challenged. So I switched gears really quickly after about a year and threw myself headfirst into design. And the first job I got was at a PR company, and that was where I first discovered really what magazine writers did. And I instantly knew that was where I hoped to be one day. And the blog was sort of originally started as a way to hopefully get my foot in the door one day at a design magazine, but it actually ended up becoming the magazine that I always wanted to write for.
Yeah, wow, amazing. And you literally started this in your lunch hour, as I understand.
I did. I feel okay saying that now that I don't work at the PR agency anymore, but that was what I normally am a huge food person, but the only time I was happy to put my food down and work instead. And I was so passionate and excited to talk about the design scene that I was seeing in Brooklyn where I was living, and it seemed like the best thing to be doing with my lunch hour rather than eating a sandwich.
Yeah, I actually, that's the one thing I miss about being self-employed, because when I worked in a corporation, I used to get a lunch hour.
And
I would do all kinds of things. I'd write articles in my lunch hour. Now I don't get time to have lunch, but that's an excuse. But
yeah, lunch hours and weekends where you don't work don't exist anymore.
So House & Garden, as I understand, just came to you and offered you a job. Is that correct?
They did. It was kind of a dream phone call that I'll never really forget. Betsy Pakoda, who ran the magazine, called me and invited me in. And I thought, surely this is a joke, or at least they're going to bring me in and want me for something really, really far down the totem pole. But they were so kind and offered to pretty much let me man the recreation of their website. Mm-hmm. And then I became the sort of their main web editor. Still to this day, one of the best jobs I've ever had. They were an incredibly supportive team, especially considering it was a far more traditional magazine than I was really writing about. And they really embraced a sort of younger, edgier style and knew that was sort of where design was heading at the time.
Right. Now, how did they find you? Did you pitch to them, or how did that work?
No, I had been fortunate enough to work with some of those writers, but from the PR end of things, and they had gotten to know me. And you know, you build relationships with those writers and you speak to them casually. And I would tell people on the side that I had started this little blog just for fun. And some of them started following it. And one of them happened to be an editor there. And when they heard that there was a need for a web editor who sort of was on the younger end of things, someone suggested me. And I was just fortunate enough that it worked out.
See, that's why I always tell everyone, you never know where a resource is going to come from.
Exactly.
And nothing is wasted. Nothing is wasted.
Exactly. I think it's a good case for always trying to be prepared all the time, because when they came calling, I was ready to go and excited to do something new. So it just felt like perfect timing.
Mm. Well, I love your book. It's called Design Sponge at Home. Your website is designsponge.com. The foreword is by Jonathan Adler, and he said some really nice things about you. I mean, it's not one of those generic, yeah, Grace has written a book. And he said, there was one bit in here I didn't want to write on the book, but he said that in the 18 years that he's been in the design business, he's had some fab moments and some hard knocks. It's been fun, but it would have been a whole lot easier if he'd had your book, your blog, to show him the way.
It was very nice.
So tell us how the book came into play. It's from your blog. How did this come into play?
Well, it's funny because I'd actually been talking to different publishers since about 2006 about doing a book, but nothing ever really felt right. And Artisan, the publisher that we went with, ended up being the perfect fit that I didn't even know existed, because they not only sort of embraced the full vision of the book that I had, but they let me work with the art team that I've worked with since day one on my website. And that was really important to me, that the book visually feel like an interpretation of the blog and not like a completely different version of what everyone had gotten accustomed to. And they really were behind the idea of me cramming as much information as I could possibly fit into one book. And typically publishers want you to sort of narrow things down and just talk about homes or just talk about do-it-yourself projects. But I really wanted to put all of the wealth of information that we produce on the site every day into book form, and they were behind it. So mm-hmm. we really ran with things.
Interesting. One of my favorite parts of the book is the trash to treasures section.
Those are great.
Amazing stuff in here that you've made from stuff that other people might just throw out.
That's one of my favorite things. And that section is almost entirely from our readers, which makes it one of my favorite parts of the book, because I think it's great proof that anyone can do projects like that, because those were all things that readers had shared with us over the years or shared with us when they knew we were working on the book. So I love having input from the people that we get to talk to every day on the site.
And just to give an example of the kind of things that's in there, I mean, the one that I liked, because it's just very rustic, it looks really sophisticated in this room, and that's the somebody stopped at a lumber yard on their way home, and for $5 they picked up a chunk of wood, just a like a tree trunk that had been smoothed out, and spray painted it, stuck a $10 mirror on top of it, and you have an elegant table there.
Exactly. That's Michelle. Yeah, she does a great job. I think it's really special when people can look at something that someone else would throw away and imagine a completely different life for it. And I think sometimes just seeing that in action can inspire that in somebody else. And that's what I was hoping for with that section.
Mm-hmm. And I've been looking for a bed, day bed for the spare room. And I've seen the prices of them and I've seen how uncomfortable they are. So I've been procrastinating. You have one here that was created for $55, took 3 hours, using old wooden pallets that somebody had thrown out. Mm-hmm. Amazing.
Those are one of our favorite materials to work with, because you can typically find them in the back of just about any industrial building. And as long as you clean them up and treat them, they're great building blocks for anything.
Yeah. So where do most people go wrong when they want to start redecorating, when they want to change their room entirely?
I think the biggest mistake people make is trying to do something on a large scale rather than starting with one small piece. I think people think they need to have this completely cohesive vision from top to bottom, but that's understandably incredibly overwhelming. And I think you should always just start with one project or one aspect of the room that you're most excited about. And if that goes well, it really inspires you to keep it going throughout the rest of the space. So that's why I put the do-it-yourself projects into the book, because I thought, you know, if you don't feel like you're up to tackling an entire room makeover, you can just make a day bed or just make a headboard or maybe even just a small side table. And once you get that confidence under your belt of having nailed one project, it really gives you steam to move ahead with the rest of the space.
Right, right. And some of these projects are extremely cheap to do yourself. Why was that important to you to include that in here?
I mean, I think it's a given these days that almost everyone's working on a budget, and I think a lot of people think that we try to push it in that direction, but it's actually just the natural extension of the way we all live. I don't think myself or any of the rest of our team really has a large amount of money to work with, so We try to use found materials or things you can grab at flea markets. And I think the nice thing about working with lower budgets and found objects is it gives you the freedom to feel like you can make a mistake. When you work with really expensive materials or a piece of furniture that you spend hundreds of dollars on at a store, it makes you really timid about being able to customize it or change it on your own. But if you're working with something that you picked up for $10 at a yard sale, there's so much more freedom to take a risk and try something different. And I think that's really when creativity happens.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know this getting this book out was a dream of yours. And I think especially in a creative field, it's sometimes hard to feel as though you've made it, even though other people are telling you how wonderful your work is. Was there a point for you where you actually had that feeling like, wow, I'm getting there. I've done it. I've made it.
Feel that way. I think I'm probably my harshest critic, and so I think that whenever I finish a project, I try to bump up the bar a little bit higher. So the book is definitely the hardest thing that I've ever done, and it's still a little bit surreal. I have it sitting in front of me right now, and it still doesn't even almost feel like mine. I feel like I look at my own name and don't know who that is. But I like to always push myself harder, so I'm excited to think about the second book and what we can do from here. So I think I'm always trying to push the bar higher, but I'm really, really happy and proud of how the book turned out.
Yeah. Now, let's talk about the blog a little, because you've got all kinds of things on there, like planning for a wedding and mixing a drink. Talk a little bit about that and what your intent was with the website.
Sure. I mean, for me, the blog has always been more of an art project than a really cohesive business plan. I think as I've gotten bored with things that we have been talking about for a few years, I decided to expand into areas like, you know, drinks or recipes or entertaining ideas, because they're things that just have become of interest to me as I've gotten older. And I mean, I started the site when I was 23, and I'm 30 now, so my interests and my needs around the house are a lot different than they were when I was fresh out of college. So I've just decided to add topics as I felt a need for them myself, or as I felt a need for them in the readership. And we have a large section of business advice, which doesn't normally seem like a natural extension for a design website. But I started working with these independent designers so often, and I realized that we were in a position to be able to help them with information. And I figured, why not turn that into a column? So I think as I see a need for something, I add it to the site. And I only add things if it feels like there's really a hole in the market for it, or if we can fill it in a way that's really important. Mm. So I think things have always grown organically based on what people need.
Yeah. And I read here that you have 75,000 daily readers on the main site and over 121,000 on the syndicated feed. How did you grow your blog? I ask that because I have a lot of people listen, and a lot of people I work with who try to grow a blog or try to grow a website, and to no avail.
I mean, I think trying is actually usually the biggest mistake, because your readers can sense that. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things where it's like you can sense, dogs can sense fear. I feel like readers can sense desperation really strongly. Right. And obviously I wanted to talk to people when I started my blog, but I think what I was most concerned about was really expressing who I was and what I was interested in a way that felt relatable. And I think that when an audience can really connect with who you are as a person and not just the ambition behind what you're doing, that's when you really create loyal followers. And I know that's the only thing that really, I think, set us apart, was I was never trying to get from point A to B. I was just trying to talk about the things that I enjoyed. And I think that, for me, I was talking about something that wasn't really highly prevalent in the design scene yet. I was talking about indie design and people working with found materials, so I had something slightly different to say. So my biggest advice for people starting blogs or running their own blogs already is to really embrace what it is that's different about what you love or different about who you are, and make that the focal point of your blog, because, you know, there are like 9 million blogs out there now.
Oh, yeah.
So the best way to stand out is to have something different to say that's genuine to who you are.
Yeah, and not be afraid to use your own voice.
Yeah, I think people feel like you should sound super professional, and there's nothing wrong with being professional about running your blog, but I think having a voice that's not authentically your own, it really limits you eventually, because you don't feel comfortable to talk about the things that you enjoy, and that's what people really click with.
Mm-hmm. There was an article on here, and I'm not sure if you wrote it or one of your team, but it was somebody was just heading back to the East Coast, and they'd taken pictures of their favorite parts of Portland.
Was that you?
I thought it was you. Okay, so talk to us a little bit about what you loved about Portland and the roof gardens, because this is what I love about Portland too. And I have to share this with you, because you said that You said that some of the buildings remind you of the real-life Tolkien Hobbit home. And last time I was in Portland, I actually I slammed on my brakes and I reversed my car back up a hill because I wanted to take a photograph of this house, which I swear was straight out of Lord of the Rings.
There's a lot of that happening in Portland. I mean, I think I love everything about Portland from top to bottom. I decided to spend a month there this summer because of that. And for me, it feels like a natural extension of the community that I so love in Brooklyn. And I think that there are a lot of creative people there. There are a lot of people who've chosen to sort of forgo the traditional path and whatever field they're working in exchange for doing something on their own. And that sort of spirit of entrepreneurship and just spirit of DIY, really, is so, so popular there. So I think that's why I felt most at home in Portland. And it was just a nice place to escape for a while. It's so quiet and everything's so green and the air is fresh. So it's just an awesome place to be for a while.
Mm. Now, you founded the Annual Design Sponge Scholarship in 2007. Tell us a little bit about that.
That was another example of something just growing out of necessity. I was working with student designers in terms of covering them. I was going to their shows in New York as often as possible. And the one thing I noticed that was really hindering students was not being able to afford various things, whether it was the supplies they needed to, you know, experiment with a new material or the money to support an unpaid scholarship or an unpaid internship that would have been really important for them to grow. And I figured out that all the existing scholarships they could get were really limiting. It specified that the funds had to go to tuition or had to go to a very specific project. And I felt, you know, if I'm not supporting this next generation, who am I going to be writing about for the next 5 or 10 years? And if this generation isn't supported, you know, that's a problem. So mm-hmm. I figured if there was any way I could help, I would. So I funded the first year's scholarship entirely on my own. And then from there on out, we would work with a small group of independent businesses to help fund it. And it's basically a no-strings-attached scholarship that we give to undergraduate and graduate students every year. And they can use that money however they see fit, because I think they know better than anybody else what they really need to flourish.
Wow. And so far, I read that over 20,000 in prize money has been awarded to students across the country.
Yes, it's great. I'm really excited. We even have international students applying now. So it's a really fun project. I'm glad we've kept it going all these years.
Mm. And for women who have design-based businesses themselves, women who are running them, I understand you have a national series of meetups. Tell us about those.
Yes, I started that in 2008. Again, just out of necessity. I joined a small group in Brooklyn of women who ran their own businesses, and we would meet up for wine and cheese, and we would just talk and commiserate about how difficult it was to run your own business. And someone said, I wish I could go to a meeting like that. And because people know that I tend to organize things when nobody else will, they said, you should set something up. So I set up a small meetup in Brooklyn, and it went from 20 people to about 200 people really quickly. And then I thought, well, every city needs one of these. So I just decided to do it by myself. So I went to about 10 cities in 2008 and organized free, basically information sessions. And everybody came and they would rotate and talk to different experts who gave them free legal advice and business advice and tax advice and anything we could think of that I thought would be important to help them get a leg up with their business.
And that's amazing. That's amazing. And, you know, I think giving back like that is really important when you've had, you know, good success as well. And,
absolutely.
And it's just that karma thing going around. If somebody's thinking of getting into design, you know, I look at your path and, you know, many kids today or parents tell their kids today, you know, you can't get into the arts. It's not going to pay. Don't go into anything creative. It's not going to pay. But we all know what's happened with the economy in so-called serious jobs. What kind of advice do you give people who want to get into a design or creative career?
I think the most important thing that you need to make it in the creative community, or really any community at this point with the current job market, is sort of a self-motivated spirit. I think that if you've got that, you can make it in anything. I mean, I think that a lot of the people I know who went a more traditional path and went to business school are having just as hard of a time getting a job right now. So I think that if you're motivated and you're willing to work, then you're going to be able to find something. A lot of the kids that I see coming out of design school, they really have a level of humility that a lot of us didn't have because we expected that we would be handed these jobs if we did well enough in school. But a lot of these younger kids who are in their early 20s know that they're going to have to work for maybe 4 or 5 years before they really start making an income that they feel comfortable with. So I think that if you feel motivated and open to learning, you're going to be fine. And, you know, be open to the fact that you might have to work a second job. I mean, I think I worked 3 or 4 or 5 jobs while I was starting Design Sponge just to be able to keep that up. And I'm really glad that I did. And I think most of the people who succeed in the arts have that, you know, ability to work a couple different jobs and keep their mind open about how they need to learn. So if you've got that open mind and the ability to work, you're going to be fine.
Fantastic. Fantastic advice. I loved hearing your story. I love hearing great success stories. And you're still so natural and humble, and I appreciate that too. What would final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with? We have about 20 seconds.
I hope they'll come join us. We're having a meetup in Seattle, and we're really going to celebrate DIY spirit. And it's on September 29th at Anthropology downtown. And we're going to be raising money for Art Core, which is a fantastic Seattle arts charity. So
super.
I hope people will come join us.
Super. Now, I had heard that it's sold out, but people can find out more at designsponge.com. And I want to thank you for tuning in today. I want to thank Grace Bonney for being with us right now, her book, Design Sponge at Home. And please come back and join us next week. We'll have an all-new live show. And until then, live well, live strong. Thanks for tuning in to Conversations Live.